Good afternoon, Montreal, and everybody listening on the World Wide Web. I'm here with Rick McConomy. There was a lot of material to choose from this week about how to plan this show, but several stories, local, national, and international, came together and they resonated because they showed how people are working together to demonstrate ways of response. Whether it's on local issues of people who think they're getting the raw end of the deal in everything from affordable housing to having their neighborhoods exploited, whether there are issues on the national level of institutional intimacies between corporations and government, and whether then the international level on questions of the degree of freedom of speech and the degree of tolerance we have to show for those who are opposing it. So we're bringing all these together, all these elements together, and we're going to start in our first hour with several guests from Point St. Charles who are fighting the casino move. And it's an interesting combination of guests because it's Jason McDevitt, who's chair of the CLSC Point St. Charles, and Serge Chevalier will be here with us representing the Quebec Department of Public Health for Montreal. We're going to be speaking to Céline Colombe, the executive director of Femmes et Jeunes, on the problems of affordable housing and the new condo development, the Imperial Tobacco renovation in Saint-Henri, as well as with Louis Goudreau of the citizens' rights group Papier. In our second hour, we're going to go to Europe, and we have three fascinating guests from London, Lord Greville Janner, from Paris, philosopher Alain Finkielkraut, and from Rome, Professor Deborah Lipstadt. On several issues, we're going to continue the discussion, of course, about the demonstrations and the, quote, outrage over the cartoons, but we're also going to talk about the horrible death at the hands of French Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy called an anti-Semitic gang, the horrible death of a 23-year-old man named Ilan Halimi. And we're also going to talk about the conviction of David Irving for Holocaust denial, something, and whether these kind of hate laws are appropriate and whether they are not in themselves infringements of freedom of speech. And right after this break, however, since everything starts at the top, we're going to be examining what's happening in Ottawa. And we're going to be talking to Globe and Mail columnist and Chrétien biographer Lawrence Martin, who wrote Iron Man on his views of the Harper government, as well as University of Ottawa law professor Aaron Freeman, co-author of The Laws of Government, The Legal Foundations of Canadian Democracy, who's just written a compelling paper on the degree to which reform of government and reform of cutting waste really begins with getting rid of the unnecessary handouts to big business. So we'll be back with you and with Lauren. We're back. Rick McConomy in studio with me. 790-0006 is our call-in number. info@iapm.ca if you want to email us. And we're starting the show today with Lawrence Martin. Lawrence, thank you for joining us this Sunday.
How are you doing?
Very well. Just a few words to the audience. Lawrence Martin is one of the best informed observers of the Ottawa scene, of the national scene, biographer Jean Chrétien, an excellent, one of the best Canadian political biographies called Iron Man. And Lawrence wrote a piece this week that really caught my eye. And Lawrence, I'm just going to quote something, and then Rick and I will talk to you about this for a while, but this leaped out at the page at me, and it wasn't the headline that I know you weren't thrilled with. A new style of governance, Lawrence wrote, is an evidence in the country. In little more than a fortnight, Stephen Harper is already showing himself to be a man in control. He has a compass. He knows what he wants and how to get there. Lawrence, is it really possible that after the micromanagement of the Chrétien years and the I'm very, very, very concerned about everything of the Martin years, we've actually got a guy who knows where he wants to go?
You know, I think that's probably true. Stephen Harper has a mind which just doesn't react to the, you know, frenetic events of any given day. It's a strategic mind, and it has a specific number of priorities, four or five for this government, which he wants to get done. In terms of the political landscape, it's a far-reaching concept at work here as well. I think he's also really learned from the last decade where the priorities have in fact not really been on the table in any clear way, and he wants to pick up on that and get a certain number of things done for Canada.
Is the press going to allow him to do that, do you think?
I sort of like his attitude toward the press.
I'll meet you when I have something to tell you.
personally, I think the media has too much power in this town of Ottawa. I think prime ministers make the mistake of letting the media set the agenda for them instead of they, as prime ministers, setting the agenda themselves. Mr. Harper has come on with a good deal of Trudeau-like arrogance in his attitude toward the media, which I feel is quite fully justified. I don't think prime ministers should have to trot themselves out every day and become overexposed and cheapen the office by answering any question that any journalist might have for them.
Or be led around by focus groups.
Yeah, you know, I think a prime minister should have a bit of detachment, and I think Mr. Harper is going to try and do that.
Well, when he was elected leader of the Conservative Party, if we all remember, he was trashed a little by the press because the next day he didn't show up with the, you know, here I am, talk to me now, I'm ready to go, you know, make me a hero. He took some time and then he came on a lot slower. I think we're probably seeing some consistency there.
Yeah, on the other side of the coin, if you look at the Harper career, he is a guy with perhaps an overly suspicious mind. And that can be dangerous as well, you know, if you're the type of leader who, you know, after taking a few hits and you feel everybody in the media is out to get you, you retreat into a bunker. And some have seen that sort of particular point in regards to Mr. Harper as having some degree of credibility. So we'll have to wait and see on that. I mean, you recall last summer when, there was that picture of him at the Calgary Stampede, which made him look like a total idiot in this Western garb he was done up in. I mean, he suffered a great deal of criticism for that and basically, you know, steered clear of the media for weeks on end.
Lawrence, you wrote that, you've written that a populist government this will not be, nor will it be one dictated by the media. You're not linking the two issues. A populist government doesn't necessarily have to be one that's led by focus groups or the media, as you've just said. So in what context is this not going to be a populist government when Harper's been trying to paint himself as sort of a prairie populist?
I don't think it would be a populist government in the sense that Mr. Harper has full confidence in his own views and his own developed beliefs. And doesn't feel it necessary to listen to all that many people beyond himself.
Somebody called this caucus recently one of the most principled caucuses in 20 years. Would you agree with that?
One of the what?
One of the most principled caucuses in 20 years, save for a few exceptions. Would you agree with that assessment?
You're talking about his cabinet?
Yes.
You know, we'll have to wait and see on that. I'm really struck by the fact that the degree to which Stephen Harper has moved toward the center of the political spectrum in the last few months. You know, if you look at his track record over time, you know, of course we know he was a reform and a reform party leader of sorts and very steeped in Reform Party beliefs, and we recall his words about building a firewall around Alberta and such. And, you know, the degree to which he has become a mushy middle centrist Canadian in terms of his overall policy outlook is striking, and I think it's a sign of political maturity on his part. It's a sign that he realizes you cannot exist in Canada successfully as a prime minister, as a political leader, unless you have that idea of where the Canadian people are at. And the Canadian people are not right of center. And he's come to realize that. And, you know, whether this is going to show up clearly in his government or not, we'll have to wait and see.
Lawrence Martin, we thank you very much for taking time out on the weekend to talk with us. And we'll be right back. Montreal, we're back with you. Rick McConomy in studio with me. The call and numbers you just heard, 790-0006. If you want to email, it's info@iapm.ca. And we've just been talking with Lawrence Martin, who brought up the question of this government that Stephen Harper has impressed as a man of character. But is it? Are we noticing some elements of caution creeping in? And how will that character be manifested? And one of the large issues that Stephen Harper ran on and addressed is cutting waste in government and cutting unnecessary handouts to business and cutting the institutional intimacies between the large private sector and government. And there are very few people in this country who could speak better to that than our next guest, Aaron Freeman. Aaron, thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure, Beryl. Good to be here.
Aaron is a law professor at the University of Ottawa. He's been involved with a lot of social action groups, including Democracy Watch, and is the co-author of a seminal work called The Laws of Government, The Legal Foundations of Canadian Democracy. So if you people out there want to know about how your government is supposed to work rather than how it's working and where you can catch them, go out and get this book. Aaron, you've written recently about the cutting waste should begin with unnecessary business handouts, and you brought some remarkable numbers into your exposition on this that Stephen Harper promised he would cut business subsidies by somewhere between $4 billion to $18 billion. Yet there has been little talk about some of the $7 to $8 billion that's going out to the oil patch, the $1.5 billion to the mining sector. And as you wrote this, the numbers came out last week of a remarkable $1.2 billion to the forestry sector in 12 different programs, including something called the Capital Cost Allowance for Forest Bioenergy and Enhanced Trade Commissioner Service and SWL Advocacy. Is this just, pardon my language, but is this just bullshit baffling brains as a way of government just getting the money out to their big supporters?
Well, I think what the government discovers once they take power is that every single one of these business subsidies represents a very well-entrenched, powerful special interest. And even if they had the inkling to do away with these subsidies, they would probably run head-on into that. I've done lots of work with environmental organizations, and what they've said is whenever they go to the government and say, let's get rid of some of these subsidies to the oil sector, to the forestry sector, the nuclear subsidies that we give out every year. The pushback that they get from government is, why don't we just spend money? It's easier for us to spend money on these issues than it is for us to take away from the business sector the subsidies that sector has fought so hard for.
And as much as Stephen Harper would want to cut down on this government overspending, and particularly in light of things like Bombardier shipping jobs overseas after receiving billions of dollars of grants, how hard is it going to be for him to fight the entrenched bureaucracy?
Well, I think he's already learned how hard it is. I mean, that promise to cut subsidies was back in 2004, during the 2004 election campaign, where he said he would cut somewhere between $4 billion and $8 billion. Well, the first thing that people pushed him to do is identify, well, what program would you start with? And he wouldn't say. He wouldn't, even during the campaign, he wouldn't identify a single business subsidy where he would start. Because, again, every one of those subsidies is a very well-entrenched, powerful economic interest, and they will fight him very hard on that.
Now, so, Harper is viewed, even by his opponents, as a man not tied to elites of any kind. So is this a matter that these business cliques are simply going to fight him on it, or is this a matter that he owes something somewhere?
Well, I think there's a bit of everything involved in this, but there is some low-hanging fruit for Mr. Harper, I think. I mean, take nuclear subsidies. We're talking about, there's the small stuff, which for the nuclear industry is something small, is $150 million a year in direct federal subsidies to the nuclear export industry. Now, this is an industry that is remarkably unsuccessful year after year. We had a report from KPMG about 12 years ago that said that the nuclear industry had to sell 10 reactors in the next 10 years just to tread water, just in order to remain, just to break even.
Aaron, if I stay with us, we'll be right back after we pay some bills in Montreal. We'd like to hear from you. Is the government doling out too much to big business interests? We'll be right back after this. Montreal after this. Lawrence Martin right after this. Montreal, good afternoon again. We're back. Rick McConomy in studio with me. On the phone is Aaron Freeman. Aaron is professor of law at the University of Ottawa, the co-author of The Laws of Government, The Legal Foundation of Canadian Democracy. He's written a very compelling piece, very compelling work that he's done into cutting government waste on unnecessary business handouts. And just before the break, Aaron, we were talking about where a government can start cutting, even a government that wants to, as this government seems to. Are the problems, one, and Rick McConomy and I were just discussing this in the break, are the problems with this that there is...
is there a sense
favors
of trade?
Owed?
Yeah, a sense of trade-off.
A sense of entitlement, that word's overused. Yeah. Or is it that you've got businessmen or business leaders who stand in front of cameras in the lobby of Parliament and tell Canadians, well, we want an open economy, no government restrictions, and then go behind the doors of parliamentary committees and tell committees, hey, look, you don't give us some money, we're moving the jobs out of the country.
It's a bit of both. I mean, there is that rank hypocrisy that you're talking about, that these same captains of industry tell us that we need deregulation and we need government getting out of their role in the economy and letting business do their own thing. Government should be steering, not rowing. So you get a lot of that, and then at the same time, these same captains of industry are going cap in hand to get billions of dollars in government subsidies. You're never going to have a business leader say, no, thank you, we really don't want these subsidies. We're doing just fine, thank you. We think that business should stick to what it does best and government should stick to its knitting. So there's definitely a bit of that, but there's a mix. I mean, there is this sort of corporate civil disobedience that happens where companies simply say to the government, if you do this, and it's not limited to subsidies, it's also in the policy realm, if you do this, you know, we'll shut down all of our plants. If you do this, you'll kill a bunch of jobs in your riding. So there's a mix. There's sort of a stick and a carrot that business uses to cajole government into giving these subsidies out. And it's also a little bit of there's a little bit of camaraderie involved too. I mean, in Canada we have a very small business elite, we have a very small political elite. And just because we're a very small country, there's tremendous overlap between the two. So, you know, that brings in the lobbying industry, which is very enmeshed and crosses that line between business and government quite frequently. So I think it's a pretty broad mix of factors that plays into these subsidies.
Is there a philosophy of accountability in the sense of we're giving you this, but you're supposed to be developing something and come back to us and tell us how successful you've been?
In theory, there is, but in practice, that doesn't play out. If you look at a program called, for example, the Technology Partnerships Program, which is basically our subsidy program for the defense and aerospace industry, these are supposed to be loans that are contingent. They're supposed to be repaid. They're supposed to be repaid when the product gets to the market. Well, in fact, there's such a tiny, tiny fraction of those loans that are repaid at all that it's really just a granting program. And I think people within the industry recognize that. And what they've said to government is, if you want a defense industry in Canada, you're going to have to pony up. And if you don't, that's fine, but you're going to be completely dependent on the United States and, to a lesser extent, other countries. To defend yourself, to supply yourself with arms and defense material.
Aaron, we thank you very much for joining us, and it's clear that we've got a very narrow end of the stick, or short end of the stick that's getting a lot, and a longer end of the stick that's getting little, and we're going to go to that end of the stick right after this. Aaron Freeman, thanks very much for being with us this afternoon. Montreal, we're back. Rick McConomy in studio with me. We've been talking about government waste, unnecessary business handouts, unnecessary business largesse to vested interests. And we have two guests right on with us right now that are going to address an issue that's very, very much in the news this past week, and that's the plan to move the Montreal Casino into Point St. Charles. And what makes this story interesting is that this move is not only being opposed by the local citizens groups, by the chair of the CLSC in Point St. Charles, but also by the Montreal Public Health Department. And we have with us Jason McDevitt, who took time out from a weekend in Boston. Welcome, Jason, who's chair of the CLSC Point St. Charles. And we have Serge Chevalier of the Department of Public Health of Montreal. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Jason, perhaps we can start with you.
Sure.
Main problem for the people in Point St. Charles with this move, as I understand it, people will be moved out of homes, and this will create more problem gambling. Is there how much of those are the critical issues, and how much more is there to this story?
Those are some big ones. Sure, real estate speculation, the problems that gambling is going to bring to a community which is fragile already and, you know, disadvantaged from a socioeconomic viewpoint, concerns about crime, which are concerns that are shared by the police.
Right.
That's why that one of the police were a main proponent for putting the casino on the island in the first place, because they could sort of control the crime that's, you know, just endemic with casinos in general. So there's crime, there's problem gambling, there's just the effect of having a 3,000 car parking lot down the street and what that could mean in terms of traffic, pollution, so many things.
Is this going to displace a lot of people who can't find affordable housing elsewhere as well?
I think that's certainly a risk. I mean, I think it's hard to predict what exactly will be the impact on real estate. I think it's possible that there will be real estate speculation because this is supposed to be a luxury hotel, recreational, touristic thing. But at the same time, we're talking about an increase in crime, too, so which doesn't typically drive up real estate prices. So it's a real complex issue. No one knows. You know, it's certainly a risk.
Jason, Rick McConomy here. Basically, there's been a gentrification movement in Point St. Charles that's some concern. Do you feel that's going to be accentuated?
Oh, definitely. I mean, when you talk to people from the neighborhood, that's a real concern generally, you know, at baseline, before this even came. People see that happen, and people see the condos that are getting built, you know, along the Lachine Canal, the old factory spaces that are getting converted into condos. And that is not development for the people of the neighborhood.
And there is quite a disparity. The Montreal average household income is $49,000. In the Point, it's $31,000. So that becomes a very important issue, Rick. Let me ask Mr. Chevalier and bring him into the conversation. Louis, for the Department of Public Health, the main issue seems to be problem gambling and controlling it.
Yeah, that's one of the main problem that we have. It stems from about two sources. The first is that Loto-Québec aims to heighten its profits. And for doing so, they need to have a larger clientele. Lotteries,
I understand, are the number one. 4 in 5 Quebecers gambled last year, and lotteries are number one, and instant win cards are number two, and then casinos are number three.
Yes, exactly. And the way we see it is that Loto-Québec wants to have more gamblers. They seek for tourists out of Quebec, tourists and high rollers. But in the past, they haven't done that great of a job bringing in tourists. They've never reached their objective. As a matter of fact, when they opened the casino in 93, their objective was 25% of the clientele coming from outside of Quebec. And the most that they reached was a little under 12%.
Serge, it struck me, and I think it struck Jason less so because he's so involved down there, but it struck a lot of people that here is a department of government, and the director of that department, who is coming out and saying, no, Quebec government, no, Montreal government, you may support this casino, but this is wrong. Is this unique?
No.
For the health department to come out against what the political leadership wants?
No, it has happened as the latest was the Highway 25. Which was going to bring up more problems than it would solve. Mm. It's just the same with the casino. It's not just that it's going to bring in money. It's going to bring in also problems, health problems to the population.
Health problems in the sense of addiction to gambling, and that you're, in fact, making it more and more accessible.
You're making it more and more accessible for Montrealers in general, and you're making more and more accessible to people that are already living in area that are living hardships.
Yes, and the vulnerability of the people that get into a gambling addiction when they have a low revenue and low hope
will make it so much more dangerous.
Right.
Jason, Serge, we ask you to stay with us. We're going to pay some bills. We'll be right back with you. And Montreal, do you want the casino moved? Call us. Montreal, Beryl Weisen back with you with Rick McConomy in studio, and we're talking with Jason McDevitt, chair of the CLSC Pointe-Saint-Charles, Serge Chevalier of the Montreal Department of Public Health, and we're talking about whether you want the casino moved to Pointe-Saint-Charles, whether you want it and whether it should be done, and what the health risks are and the communal risks are.
Serge, how is this happening? Is it on the verge of being decided? Is it still something in the hopper? What's the timeline?
Oh, the timeline for the Coulomb report that is overlooking all of the aspect of the casino move is within a few days, within 10 days at the most. The report will be handed out to the Minister of Finance.
And Jason, do we have an idea what that report's going to tell us?
Well, I mean, the two reports we've heard about so far, the public security report and the Santé Publique public health report, are both negative. Both view the project negatively. So I can't believe that it's going to be a very favorable report overall.
Jason, let me be the Jason and Serge, but I think this is more for Jason. Let me be the agent provocateur here. We've heard that this is necessary for the overall plan to revitalize downtown Montreal. Now, how much of this is that, and how much of this is just real estate speculation with people with buddies in high places? What's the feeling on the street?
I think the feeling on the street and the point would be people would say, sure, if you want to invest public funds in the neighborhood or near the neighborhood to revitalize things, that's great. We certainly need it, but we could think of so many projects that would be much more socially responsible and beneficial to people than rebuilding the casino with $1 billion in public funds.
Or bringing in the Cirque du Soleil and having to spend $100 or $150 on a ticket to get there.
Yeah, that's a pretty, I think people in points, I mean, I know in Quebec generally the Cirque du Soleil is a pretty popular thing, but I don't think people in the Point typically go see the Cirque du Soleil.
Is there an employment impact? Is there people in the Point that get jobs or end up having work because the casino comes there?
Well, a lot of Quebec has said that they're going to have some preferential hiring. There's a bit of skepticism about that for a couple reasons. We've heard that before with other businesses that have come in. It didn't really work out. And also, again, generally, if you spend $1 billion anywhere, it creates employment. There's nothing special about the casino. In fact, I think the casino isn't the best way to do that because the casino already exists. All the employees are going to move with it. You know, there might be some additional jobs, but it's not like all the people that currently work at the casino are going to quit.
Gentlemen, stay with us for 1 second. We're just going to take a call from
our first caller of the day.
Hello?
Good day, sir. How are we doing today?
We're doing fine. What's your name?
Okay, well, I'll give you an alias. I'm a victim of the casino. I don't know, people talk about real estate and this and that, but why don't they get to the core? It's the people that are suffering.
People are suffering. What's your first name?
Well, I'll tell you any name. My name is Mark Anthony, but it doesn't make a difference. My name is...
How are you suffering?
I'm in the streets, buddy. I was a wealthy businessman, and ever since the casino popped out in 92, my life started going down, 95, 96, 97. Lost a house, lost a wife.
So you're a victim of problem gambling.
Big time. So why don't they put the money that they have and put it to people like us, help us out for gamblers? Like make a little place and really help out the people, show instead of going to make more money. And to get their 25%,
this is a good question, Mr. Chevalier. Is there how much of the budget of the monies that are taken in by lotteries and gamblings by the Quebec government is put aside to help problem gamblers?
Oh, less than 1%.
Less than 1%?
Yes.
Less than 1% of the billions taken in?
Yes.
And are these direct government programs?
Oh, in the budget that it sends to the government is split in three parts: one for treatment, one for prevention of problem gambling, and one for research on problem gambling.
Jason, Serge, could you stay with us for a couple of more minutes? Mark, stay on the line. We'll be right back after this. 1% of the billions for problem gambling solutions. Remarkable. Today, about how the rich get richer, the privileged get more power. And how citizens can fight back, whether it's against governments handing out more money to businesses, or whether in this case, as we're talking right now with Serge Chevalier of the Department of Public Health of Montreal and Jason McDevitt, chair of the CLSC Pointe-Saint-Charles, about the problems with the casino moving into the Point and Serge Chevalier just told us that only 1% of the billions that Quebec gets in from gambling revenues go to the rehabilitation of problem gamblers. We just had one on, a gentleman named Mark, who lost everything in the 90s due to problem gambling. And Serge, Jason, stay with us for one more angry caller, and then we'll let you get back to your Sundays. Andy's on the line. Andy, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You know what I compare this to? It's like the government, the colonial government, and the Indian reservations. As soon as the government or the people in power found out there's oil in that land, they moved the reservation. And the people who's living there now, the idea is to force them out because there's more money with the casino for the public purse and hell with the population.
So you're comparing this to the colonial era when people would be pushed out of...
Yes, it's exactly the same thing, because once the casino goes in there, the people who have been living there, they won't be able to afford living there, because the evaluation will jump, and he will have to sell the house, and the entrepreneurs or the leeches will come in, buy up the single houses, build up the condominiums, and there goes the population.
Stay with us, because we're going to get into that on the St. Henry issue, but I wanted to ask Serge. Serge Chevalier, I know this isn't exactly what you can comment on, but is there a psychological aspect to a neighborhood being attacked? Is there people feel are displaced? They feel that they have no voice, they're powerless, their government's not protecting them. Does that fall anywhere into the realm of public health?
Oh, absolutely. This is one of our main concerns. The impact are already showing.
The feelings of alienation?
Feeling of alienation, just like your last caller said, one of the major aspects that the population is against is the way that the process went. The project was imposed on them, and that is a community that is very, very much taking care of their own selves, and they are feeling quite depossessed at this moment, and they feel anger towards the project and towards Little Quebec.
They were empowered by the structures they put in place on their own, and the government ran over the top and ignored all of that. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
And we thank you for sharing some time with us on Sunday and taking the time out from a weekend.
Come back to us, because we're going to have the Colombe Report. We're going to want you to come back on the show.
Come back to him.
Thank you, sir.
Serge, thank you very much. Sure. Andy, stay with us, because we're about to talk about the St. Henry housing issue, which is right on what you were saying, Andy, about being dispossessed, about everybody seeing a gold mine. It's like a gold rush of 1849, isn't it? Andy?
You know that when farmers owned the land in certain areas, and the people like the Rockefellers moved into the area, and hook or crook, they made the farmers gold.
So that's the taking over. It's actually an expropriation of the land without any indemnity, right?
Yeah, but there won't be. And the thing is this, even if the people stay there, as like the gentleman said, there will be no new jobs, because the casino does not create more jobs. And the casino actually is a failure because it did not attract the tourism that it was supposed to. So you are actually sucking out the money from the people that are living. This, you know what it should be? Like, just like in Monte Carlo, the local people have allow them to gamble.
Yeah. Andy, just stay with us. We're going to pay some bills, and we'll be right back with Céline Colombe and Louis Goudreau, and we're going to talk about this very issue. So, Andy, stay with us.
Okay.
We'll be right back after this. Montreal, we're back. Rick McConaughey is in the studio with me, and we're talking about how citizens can make a difference by banding together, by forming alliances. We've just finished the discussion about the problems of the casino moving into Pointe-Saint-Charles. We had a last caller was Andy, who was talking about the problems of Pointe-Saint-Charles and indeed of St. Henry's being a land rush, like a gold rush. And our next two guests are doing what the most that anybody can do to protect the citizens of Saint-Henri from the planned condo redevelopment that will put almost no affordable housing into the area. Céline Colombe, Executive Director of Famille Jeune, that helps young families get housing. Welcome, Céline. And Louis Goudreau of PAPIR, the Projet d'Organisation Populaire d'Information et Regroupement, who is head of the Citizens Coalition, or part of a Citizens Coalition. Bienvenue, Louis. Bienvenue, Céline.
Hi.
Now, as we understand it, the problem with the redevelopment of the Imperial Tobacco Plant is that there really is no logement abordable or affordable housing. This is logement abordable condo accès. which nobody in that area could possibly need, and 4,000 people may be in a real, real jam trying to get housing. Is this right?
Yes, it's right. The people live in the neighborhood of Saint-Henri or Little Burgundy. I have so much trouble with money. The people is live in poverty. And since 10 years, so many condos grew up in Saint-Henri around Canal Lachine, and this is not good for the people live there.
Louis, has there been any progress made with Préval, the developers, in getting some of the units in this redevelopment for logement abordable, that is affordable housing rather than affordable condos?
Well, there has been, the developer, Préval, has accepted to include in his project 15% of the units on social housing, which means that some of them would be subsidized, so people could actually pay a decent rent in them. But the problem is it's very few units that are being subsidized or social housing, and it's very too little compared to the 400 condos that are proposed in that project, and that might have a much worse consequences on the neighborhood.
Is there a displacement factor here too?
Oh yeah, of course. That's what we fear. We fear that these condos, added to the 3,000 that have already been built in the past 5 years in only Little Burgundy and Saint-Henri, will drive the prices up of housing and drive people out of the neighborhood eventually. People who are poor.
This is a classic case of gentrification. When the housing comes in, it's so expensive that the people that were living there previously just can't stay.
Yes. Yes, it's a classic of a former industrial neighborhood that after a big industrial activity gets transformed into another kind of use that is more painful for the development.
So the small worker that was working at minimum wage that would be showing up at the factory and be able to walk from home to the factory itself has turned into condominium, and the housing picture changes dramatically across the whole neighborhood.
Yes. Yes, of course.
Céline, Louis, stay with us. Right, we'll be right back. We'll be with you right after this. Montreal, we're back. Rick Economy with me. We're talking about citizen empowerment, and we're talking with Céline Coulomb, Executive Director of FemiJeune, and Louis Gaudreau of Citizens Group Papier, about the condo redevelopment in St. Henry and what that's going to do as far as putting pressure on people who can't afford expensive homes or expensive apartments.
Céline, I wanted to ask you, are you getting support from your municipal government on this?
If I support what?
Are you getting support? Est-ce que vous avez de l'aide du gouvernement municipal?
No, well, we have no money for the government municipal. No, and I think this choice to make this with the Imperial Tobacco, it's not a good help too.
Okay, is your municipal representative helping you to fight this fight?
No. We have no help on this side.
Okay, and what about Louis on your side?
Oh, well, the municipal authorities are very proud of this project. They have told us that there was nothing that they would or could do to change it. So, but because we are asking the city to buy back the building instead of allowing the Imperial Tobacco to sell it to a developer, we want the city to buy this project in order to make sure that what's going to be done in this plant will be more socially useful to the Saint-Henri's population.
Louis, première question à vous. If somebody wants to help Papier, who should they call? Where should they call?
Well, they can call us at our office. Our phone number is 514-935-4649.
And Céline, if somebody wants to help FemiJeune, where do they call?
931-5115. Exactly.
And obviously you can use all the political appui that you can get.
Excuse me.
Yes.
All the help you can need. Listen, congratulations.
We need help to have some person to come with us to work with the family, parents.
Et vous besoin l'appui politique aussi.
And yes, we need, because when we are alone, nous sentons que nous sommes très isolés.
You see, you feel like you're isolated. Listen,
you're not isolated. Bon courage. You have a lot of friends with you.
You're fighting the good fight. You're fighting the good fight. Stay with it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Louis. Thank you, Celine. Montreal, we're going to be right back after this, examining another aspect of social justice, another example of people rallying together, and that's the question of racism and the ongoing problems in Europe and the ongoing problems of Islamist violence that we've seen in Europe this week. A young man of 23 was the victim of what the French Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy called an anti-Semitic murder. His name was Ilan Halimi, who was found near some rail tracks with 80% of his body burned and a gag stuffed into his mouth and died on the way to hospital. The victim of a gang who said to his parents, if you don't have money for the ransom, go to the synagogues. And it's been identified as a crime of anti-Semitism. But we'll also be talking about the David Irving sentence. David Irving is a Holocaust denier who got 3 years imprisonment. Do we need hate laws short of incitement to violence? Or are they really sending the wrong message to the Islamist fanatics out there who we're telling we're Western pluralists? And we'll be talking with Lord Greville Janner from London and Professor Deborah Lipstadt from Rome, and we even may have a surprise guest from Paris. Stay tuned. Thank you. Montreal, we're back, and we have a very special guest with us right now from London, Lord Greville Janner of Braunstone. Lord Janner has led a remarkable career as a Labour MP, as a Labour Lord. He has been in the forefront of community conciliation, human rights, among his numerous activities. He's the chairman of the Holocaust Educational Trust. No stranger to these parts, by the way. During the war, he was actually at Bishop's College School, not far from Montreal in Lennoxville. Lord Janner, welcome, and thank you for taking time out from a very busy schedule. I know you've just come back from a trip abroad.
I have, yes, and it's a pleasure to be speaking to you.
Lord Janner, the theme of our show today is ways of response, and we're examining, in general, what can be the response to the, if I could coin this, if I could use this phrase, Islamist statism and the demands they're making in Europe today, and particularly
well,
with...
what do you mean statism? What do you mean?
The demands that Islamic communities are making as far as their ethnic particularities being respected as opposed to the traditions of a free and liberal press. In other words...
I don't think that's what it's about at all. I mean, liberal press has always had limits on it. However free your press may be in Canada, I don't suppose that you're allowed to libel people. I don't suppose that you are entitled religious hatred is not something which is... permitted in the UK. I don't know about Canada, but there are limits. I don't suppose in Canada your freedom allows you to put obscenity onto your radio program.
Well, I'm not sure I would agree with all due respect to that.
You could put obscenity, you could put libel.
You could put just about...
There's no limits of any sort.
Well, you could put just about anything short of incitement to violence. And one of the issues this week has been the David Irving trial. Now, I know that you were quoted as saying that condemnation was more important than conviction in that trial.
Oh, indeed.
No,
you got it backwards. That what mattered was the conviction, not
the imprisonment.
The punishment.
Not the imprisonment.
No.
But there is a school of thought that says that freedoms are indivisible, and hate laws, short of incitement to violence, really have no place if we're going to say that we have a free press, we have freedom of expression. Naturally, you can't incite a population against one group, but that satire doesn't fall into that category.
You can incite people to murder the Jews, to incitement or saying the Holocaust didn't happen is perfectly okay, is it?
Well, is saying the Holocaust didn't happen and saying let's go out and murder Jews the same thing?
No, but when they say the Holocaust didn't happen, and my entire family in Europe was murdered by these people,
I lost 70 members. Lord Janner, I lost.
Years ago, he's now retreated on it. What he said then was that it didn't happen, that this was exaggerated.
But, Lord Janner, I lost 70 members of my family, and I was born in Russia, and that lesson is not forgotten on me, and I ran the first Holocaust symposium in Montreal. But the point is...
You must be pleased with the result of the trial in Austria.
Actually, I'm not.
Because our law doesn't permit it.
Actually, I'm not, because the 11 countries that have the hate laws that don't allow this... I am not offended. I am offended personally, but I'm not offended as a citizen. If somebody wants to say the Holocaust didn't happen, I'll take him on in the court of public opinion and I'll win. Or I'll take him on in the courts and I'll win as Professor Lipstadt did. I don't need the government, pandering to every ethnic group's particularities and whittling down freedom of expression.
That's not what happened in the Lipstadt case. What happened was, it was a libel action.
I understand that.
So, I mean, this wasn't... It was totally different. It was a civil action, not a criminal one.
I understand that, but that's why I said, if I'm offended by something somebody said, I can take them on in the court of public opinion. If we have laws that constantly restrict what we're allowed to say, even in terms of satire, it becomes nanny state control of what we're trying to say, does it not?
There is always a limit, isn't there? I mean, nanny state control. Yes, of course you mustn't do that. Of course you must allow people to make jokes and so there are limits. But the limit in Austria, which was a worse country during the days of the Nazis than Germany.
Yes, it was.
Oh, yes.
Yes, it was.
There was a famous joke about. The Austrians were the best diplomats in the world. They convinced the world that Hitler was a German and Beethoven an Austrian.
Yes, they did.
It isn't so now, I'm happy to tell you. I am working there even now. It's not what they... What we have a problem with in Austria is that they have in Vienna items of great value, art, which belonged to the families of Holocaust victims, which would have to be handed back to the families, but can't be because they've been put into what is, quote, a private collection, unquote, that half the directors are appointed by the state. So, you know, we're working with them on all sorts of things. This is a living issue, and I, for my part, I'm glad the man was convicted, whether he's sent to prison or not is not the issue.
Lord Janner, on the larger subject of what's happening in Europe, surely there is a problem when a community responds to something relatively innocuous like the Danish cartoons by going and destroying private property, attacking people, and having these mass demonstrations.
Yes, I agree with you. My view is that the Muslim community should react as the Jewish communities have reacted. I have just been in Arab states on a project for the last week, and even then I saw cartoons, caricatures in newspapers, which could lead to the sort of reaction from Jewish communities that these caricatures and cartoons got from the world Muslim communities. I think I don't like this sort of treatment of communities, whether it's the Muslim community or the Jewish community. The question is how you react. Now, in my view, it is perfectly reasonable to get a reaction from Muslim communities when somebody tries to make jokes about Islam, about the Prophet Muhammad, which they find unacceptable. I believe this. Unacceptable. You shouldn't do it, and you shouldn't publish it.
But the kind
on
of reaction,
on the other hand, the reaction to it has been, in my view, not appropriate.
Lord Janner, I thank you for your time and good luck with your project. And I'll let you go and unpack from what I know has been a grueling trip.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
All the best.
All the best to you.
Bye
bye. That was Lord Greville Janner from London, Montreal. We're joined today by Professor Deborah Lipstadt. Distinguished professor at Emory University, who's on sabbatical in Rome and has generously given us several minutes of her time from there. We're discussing today ways of response, the proper ways to fight back, not just on social justice issues at home, but the challenges that face us abroad, the threat to Western liberalism and pluralism from the current onrush of Islamist statism, and what kind of message to send to those Muslims that think that something is owed to them, and when they're aggrieved, their appropriate response is to hit the streets. Well, Professor Lipstadt is somebody that André Malraux, the great French intellectual and minister, would have called an intellectual engagé. She doesn't just talk in the classrooms or write books, two of which I would highly recommend. One was called Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory, the other being Beyond Belief, The American Press and the Coming of the Holocaust. And they both warn of the dangers of apathy and of lethargy. But Professor Lipstadt took on David Irving. David Irving, this week, as many of you know, was sentenced to 3 years in prison for Holocaust denial in Austria. And we've been talking for several weeks about how freedom is indivisible. The appropriate approach, if you're not happy, you go to the courts, you engage in the court of public opinion, and that's just what Professor Lipstadt did several years ago when she won a libel suit against David Irving after having called him a liar and proving so, and the judgment in the case was very harsh against him. And to Professor Lipstadt's credit, when the Irving decision came down in Austria, she said, I'm against it. And I'm against it because I'm against censorship. Professor Lipstadt, welcome. Did the Irving verdict send the wrong message to the Islamists in Europe who can now say, well, Europe, Western liberalism, you're as hypocritical as you claim Islamist statism to be?
I think they will use it that way. They'll definitely use it that way, and they won't be entirely unjustified from their perspective. So you're right in that sense. By the way, I know you know this, but it may have been a little vague to your audience on the lead-in to emphasize the fact that Irving sued me in British courts for libel,
That's correct.
I went into court to defend myself. I don't believe that's correct. History belongs in the courtroom.
That's correct. Just to clarify, Professor Lipstadt had called David Irving and basically said he lied when he said that only 30,000 Jews were killed in the Holocaust, that the Holocaust was an overstatement. He sued her for libel. She won, and the court's judgment was very harsh against him, calling him a racist and an anti-Semite.
Correct.
So that was one of the most eloquent acts that could be imagined, I think far more eloquent than the destruction of property and people in the streets that we've witnessed since the publication of the Danish cartoons.
Yeah, well, it was the right way of doing it. And the irony is, had there been a British law against Holocaust denial, we never would have known the degree to which Irving perverts, distorts, lies, etc. I mean, we knew he lied, but we never knew how much he distorted the various documents on which he based his claims, because nobody had ever followed his footnotes.
Right, he could have just been prosecuted in British courts, and the facts of it would never have gotten out to the general public.
Exactly. The degree of when he puts someone at a meeting who's not at a meeting, when he changes the date of something, when he reverses the order, when he says a document says X and it says A. You know, we just never would have known that, because it's a totally unfulfilling job to follow the footnotes of a liar and show, because when you know he's lying, you say,
right.
Well, I know he's lying. I'm not going to go show you all his modus operandi of lying. But we had to do that. And as a result, my victory for me was so sweet, because not only was it so complete, but it was a sweet victory because it was based on truth and evidence and reason.
Montreal, stay with us. We'll continue our conversation with Deborah Lipstadt from Rome right after this. Montreal, we're back with Professor Deborah Lipstadt from Rome, distinguished historian at Emory University and the author of History on Trial, My Day in Court with David Irving. Professor Lipstadt, one of the things I asked Lord Janner, he had said that, commenting on the Irving verdict, he had said that a condemnation would have been more satisfying than a conviction, but he didn't go far enough, for my taste in any case, in saying that these kinds of laws, frankly, short of incitement to violence, that hate laws are actually impediments to getting at the truth. Would you go as far as that statement that I've just made, that hate laws, short of incitement to violence, are really a hindrance rather than a help?
I would pretty much agree with it. Yeah, I can't... I understand the Austrians and the Germans in terms of the historical context of their countries. These are the two countries that started the whole thing, did the whole thing, profited from it, etc. That doesn't mean I'm justifying it, but I'm just saying I'm trying to understand the context in which they made these laws. Nonetheless, I don't think they are the best way to go. I really don't think it's
Were you, as a historian, a bit taken aback by the comment of one of the witnesses at the Irving trial, Professor Hajo Funke, who said that the Anglo-Saxon ideal of freedom of expression is not for us yet in Germany and Austria. It is not our time yet. That struck me as a staggering statement of self-defeatism.
Well, Hajo Funke was a witness in my trial. He's a wonderful man. His report on the trial, I talk a lot about it. You didn't mention my newest book, if I might.
I'm sorry, certainly.
It's actually about the trial itself, and I think anybody who's listening to the show and interested in David Irving's
History on Trial. My day in court with David Irving. It's from Harper Collins.
Right, exactly. And you can read about Hajo in there. And Hajo said something during that trial when he testified. It was just so moving because his anger towards Irving is so overwhelming in the sense that he is angry for what Irving is doing to their legacy and deniers in general. I understand what he's saying. I have the luxury, let me put it this way, of living in a free speech country, living in a country that doesn't have that kind of history, and I can say, well, you know, no, I don't think so. I'm a little bit hesitant of criticizing the Germans and the Austrians also because let's remember they are a democracy and their citizens, last time I checked, you know, it's a true democracy and their citizens could vote out these laws if they wanted. So, I think that's another factor. By the way, there's one other point I want to make is that I don't think, as much as we might disagree with this sentence, et cetera, I don't want to turn David Irving into a victim. He knew there was a warrant out for his arrest. He went to Austria anyway. He not only went to Austria, but he announced that he was coming on websites and on the students' websites, et cetera. And he, he went ahead and did this. And, in fact, his partner, Biente, I think her name is, wife, partner, whatever it is, said he went with the intention of riling things up and having a little fun.
It was instigation, but we still don't jail people for intellectual instigation.
That's right, but I agree with you. But I'm not going to paint him as this victim. If I disagree with Thai drug laws and I find them draconian, and I go and take, you know, some heroin and I shoot up or hashish and I smoke it in the middle of the main square of Bangkok, I'm going to get what they impose. Now, we still don't agree with their laws, but I have put myself in that situation. If he wanted to protest, if he wanted to make a statement, he could have done something, video conference, and said to those listening, I would love to be with you, but because of you, your laws, I can't. That's, you know, so his sitting in jail is something he brought on himself as much as we might disagree with the law.
So the lesson to be learned is the laws might be faulty, but let's not shed any crocodile tears for a guy
who
knew exactly what he was doing.
Exactly. Look, if he lived there and he was just, you know, it's a different thing. The refuseniks, they lived in that country. They were fighting a corrupt system. Law wasn't really law. It wasn't a democracy. So, I think that a lot of these things have to be taken into consideration. Be that as it may, I do still think that I'm against these laws, not just on the basis of the idea of free speech, but I don't think they're efficacious. I think they turn Holocaust denial into forbidden fruit.
And perhaps trivializing them a bit as well.
That could be said as well.
Professor Lipstadt, thank you very much for your time.
You
I know you have a very
me.
Busy weekend.
It's a pleasure being with you and your audience. I love Montreal, and any excuse I get, I come back.
And Montreal loves you, and we can't forget the last time you were here, and I've talked to your host the last time and suggested that you be invited back.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Professor Deborah Lipstadt joining us from Rome, the author of History on Trial, My Day in Court with David Irving. Montreal, that brings us to the end of another show, segment of The Last Angry Man, another show this afternoon. I want to thank Rick McGonigal in studio with me, our producer Val Prudnikoff,
And I want to remind everybody that I hope what you got from the show was ways of response, that it's possible working together as citizens to challenge interests, not merely to balance them, to get help together. You want to help Céline Coulombe and Famille Jeune in St. Henry on public housing, 931-5115 is her number. Louis Goudreau at Papier, 935-4646. Aaron Freeman is doing such great work against government handouts. Jason McDevitt at the CLSC Point St. Charles. And I want to remind everybody that tonight at 7 p.m., there's a memorial service, an ecumenical one, in the memory of Ilan Halimi, the young man who was a victim of the anti-Semitic killing in Paris this week. To all Montrealers, good day, good afternoon. Info at IAPM is our, IAPM.ca is our email. Thank you, and we're out of here.